Michelangelo Merisi di Caravaggio, known to the world simply as Caravaggio, is undoubtedly one of the most important artists of the Western tradition. A new exhibition at London's National Gallery puts his last ever painting on show. The story of this painting is almost as exciting as Caravaggio's own tumultuous life. To discuss his vast legacy, I'm joined by EI's senior editor, Paul Lay. Paul, can you give a sense of Caravaggio's world, the world of the early 17th century?
Yes, he's born in Milan. Caravaggio is actually the name of the place where he was born, in Lombardy, in fertile plains of Lombardy. His father is a stonemason, a skilled job, and his mother is relatively well connected, so it's not a background of poverty. He's born into Counter-Reformation Milan, so Carlo Borromeo, a great figure or saintly archbishop, leading figure of the Counter-Reformation, is there. And yet we don't associate Caravaggio with Milan. We associate him with Rome, where he made his reputation, again, Counter-Reformation Rome. And then, of course, Naples. And it's really in Naples where I first came across Caravaggio in a meaningful sense. There's a fantastic work of art by his, a rich, deep work of art called The Seven Acts of Mercy, which, as you would expect, was commissioned for the Neapolitan Church of Piemonte della Misericordia. That would be in about 1606. It's dark, it's baroque, it's within that warren of tight streets that so embody Naples, the Anticostorico of Naples, Spacca Napoli, as it's called, Split Naples, where you get that claustrophobic sense of a world that's actually very, very close to the sea, but in which there is no sense of the sea because of these tight warrens. And this is the sort of place where Caravaggio, the bad boy, and I think we should probably discuss that bad boy image, a man who plainly had anger issues, ultimately was a murderer. He killed a man who bled to death on a tennis court. And that's just before we get to this final painting, The Last Caravaggio, as it's being called, which is now subject to this really terrific exhibition. In fact, one of the things that the National Gallery in London does really, really well at the moment are these single-room exhibitions, often devoted to one painting or one painting that's put in context with a couple of others. And he does this new exhibition, The Last Caravaggio, is a wonderful explication of the very, very late Caravaggio, this man running from his life. He literally has a price on his head, and he's still producing these great dynamic works, and perhaps these most typical of what we think of Caravaggio's work: dark, tight, cinematic, highly realistic works based on either myth or on biblical stories, which he so excelled.
How revolutionary is that realism?
Well, it was very revolutionary, I think, and it was perceived as revolutionary at the time. I think it's one of the reasons why Caravaggio is lost from the records during, say, the 18th, 19th centuries. He's not regarded as a great painter. He's not there with Titian and Veronese or the other great figures of the Renaissance until really the 20th century. And in fact, the first time I came across Caravaggio was a myth-making film. It was a film by Derek Jarman, made in the 1980s. Derek Jarman, he's probably best known now for his house in Dungeness that he created that attracts lots of visitors every year on the Kent coast. But actually, during the 1980s, Derek Jarman was a really, really significant figure in British culture. And he wrote, he directed and produced a series of really quite remarkable films, avant-garde, and perhaps the most straightforward of his films, in terms of narrative, is called Caravaggio, and it is a biopic of the artist. And you can see what attracts Jarman to him. He is this bad boy. There's a homoeroticism about it. There's a beauty about it that I think owes something to the work of Pier Paolo Pasolini, the great Italian film director. And I think back to his Gospel According to St. Matthew, made in the 1960s, which, like Jarman, hugely influential on Derek Jarman, because he took brutally beautiful young men, which are often in Caravaggio's paintings as well, and finds beauty in a kind of ugliness, the street, in poverty, which is the sort of thing that people get off in the 20th and 21st century. I am not actually that big a fan of Caravaggio. I can see why his work is remarkable. I can see why he's thought of as a great artist, and he is a great artist. But there's something about his work that appeals to a 21st century mind, that seeks authenticity, that seeks the street, that seeks the bad boy, whereas I'm much more the sort of person who's attracted to, say, a Veronese or a Titian. And he's actually quite interesting in the way that it's been reviewed, this Caravaggio, overwhelmingly positive. Whereas I think the other really interesting exhibition that's taking place in London at this moment, which is dedicated to the portraits of John Singer Sargent, which is at Tate Britain, has been criticised often by male reviewers, male critics, because in many ways it's too beautiful, it's opulent, it's wealthy people, it's privileged people. But I would argue that in terms of portraits, it's every bit as fascinating as Caravaggio. And so what we talking about when we think of Caravaggio, we think of a Singer Sargent, we're seeing them, as always, through the prism of our own time.
I think E.H. Combrick said that Caravaggio believed that to be afraid of ugliness seemed a contemptible weakness. And I tend to agree with you, Paul, not because I'm afraid of ugliness and can't stand ugliness, but that aspect of contempt. There is an element in Caravaggio's work that strikes me at times, that kind of sense of, you know, contempt for people who want to look away sometimes. And, I mean, Gombrich also said that Caravaggio wanted truth. Well, he wanted his vision of truth. Mm. And I think there are many other ways of representing the human figure that Caravaggio is not interested in, and also aspects of human experience that don't include the human figure. I always think Caravaggio is so obsessed with the ugly reality, that kind of acridity of the human experience.
Yep.
But there are soft elements of the human experience that I'm not sure he's particularly interested in. So, you know, I tend to agree with you. I mean, I'm particularly, to be frank, and I was looking at through some of Caravaggio's greatest paintings last night, most celebrated paintings, that whether it's cowardice on my part, but that T.S. Eliot quote, which is in a very different context, humankind cannot bear too much reality, strikes me when I look at Caravaggio's work, that there is too much reality for an artwork. There's not enough transfiguration. There is a very acute perception for human cruelty. I'm thinking of The Burial of St. Lucy, that painting, which it's such a brilliant portrayal of kind of everyday cruelty. The nastiness, the kind of lack of care, the cruelty that pervades human interactions. It's so acute, it's so accurate.
Yeah.
That I want to look away and say, well, you know, maybe life isn't like that, or it shouldn't be like that.
Yeah, I first came across The Burial of St. Lucy in a very ramshackle museum, if you can call it that, in Syracuse, where it is now, and there were just a couple of people. I was the only person in that room looking at it. It was as though you were in some kind of student accommodation where this remarkable painting was against the wall. And there were just a couple of young curators overseeing it. And it's a remarkable work. I actually think it's Caravaggio's, or among Caravaggio's, really greatest works, in that it's very cinematic, it's tightly cropped, it's brutal, and it's very, very frank. He casts a very cold iron brutality. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And that's a real masterpiece. And I think what we're seeing in Room 46 at the National Gallery is a similar sort of work. I think of Caravaggio's work, it's among some of the best. And it's described by the curator, Francesca Whitlam Cooper, who's written a very, very good accompaniment to the exhibition, and in fact gave a very good talk at the Press View. She described the work that is the focus of this new exhibition, that is, Caravaggio's The Martyrdom of St. Ursula, as a symphony of hands. And I think that's a really wonderful description, because hands are the focuses. They're very prominent, and they drive this real narrative of violence towards St. Ursula.
Who was St. Ursula?
Well, yes, indeed. This subject of Caravaggio's last painting, and we now know it's the last painting, and we should come to that story of the painting itself in a moment. But first of all, the subject matter, the tale of St. Ursula, is derived from the Golden Legend, which was a biography, a collection of biographies by Jacobus de Varenya, which was compiled in the middle of the 13th century. So St. Ursula was a British, possibly Breton princess, who had been on pilgrimage to Rome and, returning, had ended up in Cologne, where she and her virginal followers, the numbers are disputed as to how many followers she had. Some claim as many as 11,000, probably inaccurate. But she was captured by the king of the Huns, who was absolutely entranced by her beauty and asked her hand in marriage, and she refused him as a testament to her Christian faith. And it is said in the Golden Legend that the king shot at her an arrow and pierced her through the body and so accomplished her martyrdom. And this is the scene that's captured in this extraordinary painting, which also depicts not just St. Ursula, but also the last self-portrait of Caravaggio himself. He often includes himself in his paintings. He's the crop-haired figure behind Ursula. He's got a very, very deathly pallor. And we should remember that he'd been slashed across the face and was suffering from some kind of fever just before this, though there's no sign of facial disfigurement in this one, though his face is partially hidden. But then there's these hands, this symphony of hands, as the curator calls it. There's a soldier's hand support Ursula in anticipation of her collapsing. She's been shot. There's an arrow in her chest. It's just happened because you feel as though the archer has fired the arrow. And it all happens very close up.
And there's blood spattering.
There's blood. It's just happened. You can almost feel the bow of the archer, the string there still quivering. It's extraordinary in that way. And there's the hand of another, which is at the very centre of the work. And this actually has only become apparent following a recent restoration, who tries to intervene to stop this arrow reaching St. Ursula, but obviously it's too late. And Ursula herself, who has this almost graceful face, she cups her breasts to focus on this mortal wound, this moment of grace in the face of death.
Grace and also a sort of blank surprise, you know, which you often see in films when someone gets shot, they have this expression of, oh no.
Yes, okay. and a very blank surprise, absolutely. But almost as remarkable as this painting, and it is a remarkable painting, whatever one's take on Caravaggio, we've talked about our caveats about his work, but nevertheless, I didn't think anyone doubts that he's not a great Renaissance artist. But the story of this painting, the story of the martyrdom of St. Ursula, is pretty much as remarkable as that of the artist who painted it. Now, until very recently, it was thought to be the work of either a painter called Bartolomeo Manfredi, who was a Roman contemporary of Caravaggio, heavily influenced by him, or a slightly younger Calabrian artist, that's Calabria in the far south of Italy, called Mattia Preti, who was very heavily influenced by his work. Now, the Italian art historian Mina Gregory had suggested in the mid-1970s that this work might be by Caravaggio. But there was no proof to this at all until there was a letter discovered in 1980 by the historian and scholar Vincenzo Pacelli of a letter in Naples, Stato Archivo, the state archives there, which was dated to the 11th of May, 1610. And this letter was in the hand of a figure called Lanfranco Massa, who was a factotum based in Naples, acting on behalf of a Genoese nobleman, Marco Antonio Doria. Doria's a major family in Genoa, which, for those who don't know, was a rival to Venice as a maritime city-state for a long while, although it had been in relative decline by this point. But this letter referred to a painting that Doria had commissioned from the man then considered to be the greatest artist in Naples, this vast city, who was Caravaggio. And it was universally, ecstatically praised at the time, but there was some questions about the way it had been handled by this factotum, this Lanfranco Massa. And there's a quote. I'll quote from the letter itself, which is absolutely fascinating and which is on display in the exhibition. And it reads, "I had intended to send you the picture of St. Ursula this week, but to make sure of sending it perfectly dry, I put it out yesterday in the sun, which rather than drying out the varnish, made it soften, since Caravaggio applied it quite thickly. I will go round to said Caravaggio again to get his opinion on what to do so I can be sure of not ruining it. Signor Damiano has seen it and was amazed, like everyone else who has seen it." So there was a little bit of damage done
amazed
to this painting.
Or shocked.
Yes, yeah. Not good. But nevertheless, it's in pretty good condition. It's been restored. And this attribution made in 1980 was further enhanced when, during restoration, two inscriptions were revealed on the back of the original canvas. And one of the artists, and I quote again, Di Michel Angelo da Caravaggio, and the other name there is the name of the patron, M.A.D., which is Doria. So this lost Caravaggio became, as Gabriele Finaldi, the director of the National Gallery, has called it, the last Caravaggio.
There's so many meta meanings going on. You know,
no,
it's the death of Ursula.
Yeah.
Caravaggio is like Caravaggio's painting. He also looks like he's going to cop it.
Well, 10 weeks later, he will be dead himself.
He will be dead. The painting itself goes through a cycle of destruction, preservation, restoration, and loss. It disappears completely.
For a very long time.
And then it returns, and here we are. So we're at the end of this. Well, maybe not the end, but we are in the midst of this extraordinary commentary on art and loss and death.
Absolutely. And it's almost as though the one disappointment of seeing it in the National Gallery, and that's no criticism of what they've done there, it's an absolutely fantastic exhibition. But the painting, Martyrdom of St. Ursula, is usually displayed in the Galleria d'Italia on the Neapolitan street, Via Toledo. Now, anyone who knows Naples or knows Via Toledo is right in the heart of this bustling, mad city.
I've had pizza on there.
I mean, it is, in my opinion, the most pulsating, the most compelling city in Europe. And that's exactly where Caravaggio walked. And it's been restored by its owners, the Banca Intesa San Paolo, and you can see it. It's actually, the building there on Via Toledo is a fascist building, rather remarkable piece of Italian fascist architecture. And along with Jonathan Meads, I very much agree that Italian fascist architecture is among the most interesting and compelling of the 20th century. It's a long way from Albert Speer, however dubious politically it may be to say that. But it is extraordinary. I think of one only has to see the General Post Office in Naples, which was used in Bertolucci's film Il Conformista, The Conformist. Yes. Remarkable piece of work, despite the dubious politics.
It's extraordinary. I stopped to take a photo, I remember, when I walked past it. Because it's just so striking.
It's remarkable. And of course, there are remarkable buildings in that period as well in Rome. But
and the University Library in Cambridge is heavily influenced by this style.
I'm sure unintentionally. Yeah. But it's done really well in the National Gallery, because when you enter Room 46, and don't forget this exhibition is completely free, it's a very dark, sepulchral space, quite deliberately, I think. And the martyrdom of St. Ursula, which is on loan from Naples, is paired with the National Gallery's own Caravaggio, which is Salome receives the head of John the Baptist, which is again another of those brutal, unflinching masterpieces, late masterpieces, roughly contemporaneous, possibly painted a year before the martyrdom of St. Ursula. So again, very, very late period. And it's interesting, we talked about late periods and other genres and other artists as well in the past. There is this confidence that Caravaggio has here, even though when he painted these paintings, The Man on the Run, he's a man literally with a price on his head. Anyone from the Papal States can kill him and bring his head back and get a reward. Literally any citizen. That's what he's facing up to during this period. And yet he has the confidence of a man who's still regarded, as we see from the patronage of Doria, the Genoese nobleman, we see that he's still regarded as one of the greatest figures in all of Italian Renaissance art. He's on the run. He's in Sicily. He dies ultimately alone, probably of fever, in Porto Ercole.
And it's still a mystery.
He's thrown into a pauper's grave. How did he die? Probably fever, which may be still a result of this horrible disfigurement of his face that took place outside a tavern. We just don't know, even though his final days are relatively well documented, though there may be a bit of myth-making by various contemporary chroniclers there. But nevertheless, you can see why this life lends itself to drama, why Caravaggio is so compelling. That is something cinematic, not only about his paintings, but about his life.
Yeah, and he still generates kind of almost conspiracy theories about his death. Yeah, well, you see Ernest, there's quite a nice documentary by Andrew Graham Dixon where he's trying to investigate the real circumstances of his death, where he speaks to various arts historians in Italy, and each one seems to have a different conspiracy theory. Oh, it was the Papal States, or it was the Knights of Malta, it was, you know, this group were, you know, scheming for his ends. And I'm very struck by that people are still arguing about the malign forces that came together to destroy him. But, you know, maybe it was a bit more banal than that. It could have been, you know, just an infection or a malarial disease, you know, who knows.
Well, as we're addicted to Bad Boys, we're addicted to conspiracy theories as well. So, I mean, it lends, you can see why. It's really, really interesting when you go through the National Gallery, and particularly the central room where there are great paintings, like, say, for example, Veronese's vast masterpiece, The Family of Darius Before Alexander. It does not speak, or tends not to speak, to the modern mind, because it is aristocratic, it is grand, it depends upon a knowledge of classical history, classical myths, and biblical knowledge. Whereas even though Caravaggio is inspired by biblical and classical stories, narratives, figures, you can see them almost without that as just brutal barroom confrontations or just images of violence.
Something like the Incredulity of St. Thomas, you know, it looks like the three figures who are sort of bending over Jesus's frame, they sort of look like they're examining a sort of battle scar in a pub or something. They look like it's like, oh, I'll show you this.
Yeah.
And
what's
that?
And the Supper at Emmaus, the Supper at Emmaus, which is one of his most famous paintings, again, a really, really great painting. It could be just a group of gamblers in a bar in Naples. You don't necessarily need the allusions, although of course these things become so much richer with the allusions, but as biblical knowledge and classical knowledge recedes, Caravaggio comes into that space where that knowledge is no longer required, which is not true of so many of his contemporaries.
Yeah, no, he's getting beyond the classical models to what he sees as the reality.
So in that way, he's a very modern painter.
Yeah, on Bad Boys, I used to... I used to love the literary bad boy type. I mean, I did my thesis at university on the Roman poet Lucan, who was a drinking companion of Nero, Silver Age Latin poets, who writes this absolutely insane poem called The Civil War. Insane in both construction and execution and subject matter. And it's about Caesar and Pompey and all these walk-on parts of the kind of extraordinary figures of that era. And he died very young. Nero ordered his death. Mm. There are various stories that have been generated about why Nero ordered his death. Maybe he felt Nero was himself a poet, that Lucan had got too good, that there was too bright a future for him. And I love that poem. And I particularly loved it when I was a bit younger because it was sort of unfinished and the style was very acerbic and it was grandiloquent and, to put it bluntly, mad. Mm. And Carlo Gesualdo in the Renaissance, a great Renaissance composer, has also, over the centuries, his reputation has grown and grown, really, as the bad boy, a man who is alleged to have murdered a child.
Gesualdo is absolutely the perfect companion to Caravaggio in terms of the way he's been reconsidered in the light of his own personal reputation, as well as his great music.
And the music is great, but I listen to the music not because it seems to me to have nothing to do at points with that bad boy. It's highly chromatic. It's very abstract.
But it's also quite tenebrous. There is something.
There is something in the shadow, something of the night.
Chiaroscuro, I suppose you would say.
But I prefer the sort of literary nice boys. I always find the, in the, and nice girls, you know, I prefer reading a great novel. And then, I mean, I love Marcel Proust and love the novel series. I love hearing accounts of people who knew Proust who say of things like every day was like a lifetime with Marcel. He was just lovely. The same with the great Enlightenment philosopher David Hume, apparently a really nice man. Maybe it's because I'm not the bad boy I once was, but I want to hear stories about artists who went into those regions. Proust deals with terror, fear, with all kinds of, with the depths, with the abyss. But then he also retains a kind of critical distance and a kind of discipline as an artist to, and a servant of the function of art that strikes me as just praiseworthy and ultimately a tribute to the art itself. And that's why I don't particularly enjoy, as we've talked about earlier in the podcast, Caravaggio. It's just too much reality. It's like he's enjoying the gruesomeness.
Well, he's slumming it, isn't
he's
he? There's a lot of nostalgia de boe there. And I think this is, again, relocating it. When Derek Jarman was making Caravaggio, around about the time when he was really in his pomp as a filmmaker, so this would be early to mid-1980s, there was an exhibition curated by Jarman, of which there was quite a lot of cinema there. And as well as Pasolini, Gospel According to St. Matthew was there. The other stuff that was there was stuff by William Burroughs. There was Kenneth Anger's Magic Lantern Cycle. There was Jean Genet, films by Jean Genet. And so he was placing, I think, Caravaggio, when he made the film, within a countercultural tradition that really had a lot to do with the beats, that had a lot to do with homoeroticism, which had a lot to do with a particular tradition. And I don't think that was unfounded. I think you could make a claim that Caravaggio, as you could make Gesualdo, was part of this tradition. But I think he became locked into that. It was very difficult to do it elsewhere.
It's slightly self-serving as well.
There was a little bit of, you know, the leather boy about Caravaggio. You were placing him within a tradition which I don't know whether he would have seen himself as that. I don't think my sense of what I know about Caravaggio, he's not so much a rebel. He's a man who's very, very happy to work for the forces that are powerful. But actually, he's just got anger issues. He's probably just a pretty unpleasant figure, actually. And this is true of probably a lot of people we romanticise. But nevertheless, this is a theme that what is great in art is what is radical in art. And there's a real tension then. You know, you mention Eliot about reality. Eliot sees himself as a conservative. He sees himself as a different tradition. But nevertheless, those tensions are real, and you can see why. And I come back again to this idea that that is why Caravaggio seems such a modern artist for all those reasons. Even so, I will say this, that the National Gallery has done an absolutely fantastic job of contextualising this last painting, along with the image of Salome that accompanies it. It's well worth seeing.
Yep.
It's completely free. And I think, again, it shows just how good the National Gallery is at curating these small exhibitions. So do go and see it.
But just to return very quickly, Paul, just before we wrap up, the thing I worry about with on-screen violence, particularly in cinema, is not that it makes people more violent, but that it, in some curious way, anaesthetizes human beings to more fundamental ethical, political, social debates which we need to engage in. It sort of creates this sense that you can deal with the nastiness of life in the charmed circle of the cinema or in the art gallery, and actually means that in the rest of your life you sort of feel, well, I've dealt with the nastiness, I've kind of gone there, so in the rest of my life I can, you know, just fulfill my function in the workplace or just get on. We often talk in the office about how the political, broadly defined, has actually retreated from people's everyday lives in the last 30 or 40 years. You know, we're much less used to those local debates, much less used to people being involved in politics at every level of life, and much less used to having real political arguments. I'm reading John Bew's fantastic biography of Clement Attlee at the moment. If we rewind 100 years ago, politics infuses everything. It infuses Attlee's life, of course, but you get the sense that he's engaged with debates with the rest of society. And among those debates are, how do we deal with living in a very nasty world, a violent world, a world that is close to war, that we've seen a terrible war, we've seen the violence, we've actually been there, we fought on the front, we've seen the devastation, we've seen man's inhumanity to man played out at a vast scale. How are we going to deal with that? How are we going to live productively? And how are we going to make a beautiful, gentle life, which for Attlee is very much founded in that ethical vision, providential vision of a new Jerusalem, linked to a kind of love of the English landscape, a love of English manners, but not romanticism, something that just takes Englishness and England as a real living thing. But I wonder whether that appetite for on-screen violence in the modern age, or even violence in books, or violence, it sort of is just another manifestation of the retreat of the political, the retreat of the ethical, and the retreat of everyone into their kind of own interests and values. And we like to feel anaesthetized. We like to feel, to go away, to feel like we've just had a sort of little glimpse of what the nastiness of life is. But we don't think about what everyday cruelty looks like. We don't look at what we do to each other every day, that everyday cruelty. We don't look at the condition of the most vulnerable in our society. We don't really take on these things.
Well, I think that's where painting is much more valuable than cinema. Yeah. Because cinema is uniquely artificial. If you're sitting in front of, or standing in front of a Caravaggio, what you realise is it's a real physical painting. And when it comes to violence, I can't really think of anything much more violent than, say, some of Titian's paintings of satyrs being skinned alive.
Yeah.
But it is the physicality of that. When you see the brushstrokes of the late Titian, the horrific scenes that he's painting, you have the physicality there. And I think what perhaps might be worth exploring is that idea of the removal of the physical that cinema or television does. Mm. Because when he's looking at the screen, there's no doubt, and this is not true of the reproduction, this is the difference between a reproduction and standing in front of a painting like The Martyrdom of St. Ursula, like Titian's great classical
scenes. The aura,
scenes,
as Walter Benjamin.
It is the physicality of it. These are raw brushstrokes. These are raw colours. This is all physical, and you can touch it. I mean, you can't, because you'd be thrown out unless you were a kind of
Paul was thrown out.
Just stop oil protester. You'd be okay. But as a connoisseur of the Renaissance, you would be arrested.
So, but doesn't that explain the just stop oil phenomenon, that revulsion at fictive real imagination.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. Possibly. That's a subject because their allegation podcast,
is what, but, you know, but their allegation but, yeah. is that they're sort of agreeing with what I said. You know, yeah. they're saying that art distracts you from the real issues at stake.
I think we find it very difficult to deal with the physical. And I think the ultimate manifestation of physicality is death. We find it very difficult to deal with that. They didn't. And I think this is this stuff about casting a cold eye that that Yeats, of course, uses in his great poem. It is that unflinching ability to see the truth. And I think that's... He doesn't have many virtues, Caravaggio, if one reads his biography. But I think he is an unflinching observer of the world. And there is truth in his paintings. And I think that is suffice enough to make him great.
Yeah. So, yeah, the world according to Caravaggio. Well, thanks, Paul. That was fascinating. Possibly the only podcast in which both Clement Attlee and Caravaggio feature, even though Clement has a bit of a walk-on part there. Please do go along to the exhibition. I've been inspired to do that. And thanks for listening. You've been listening to EI Talks. EI Talks is produced by Alistair Benn, and the sound engineer is Gareth Jones.